This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Do you remember the moon landing? That first step on the moon likely inspired a generation of people who wanted to become astronauts, but not Leland Melvin. He never thought about going into space. In fact, he had a scholarship to play football at the University of Richmond, later signed as a wide receiver with the Detroit Lions, and then he became an astronaut. And he is among the few who has orbited the Earth on the space shuttle Atlantis. These days, he's all about encouraging young people, particularly young people of color, to study science and shoot for the stars. He has a book. It's called Chasing Space, an astronaut story of grit, grace, and second chances. And he joins us now on The State of Things. Leland Melvin, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Frank.
Let's take us back. You would have been, what, 4 or 5 years old for the moon, that first moon shot, right? Do you remember?
Yeah, I was born in 64, and so I was 5. And I remember, you know, seeing on this grainy signal coming from the moon. And I, you know, the next day everyone said, hey, do you want to be an astronaut? I'm like, no. I don't want a buzz cut. I don't want to be a test pilot. I don't do any of those things. And I remember, you know, Arthur Ashe trained in Lynchburg, Virginia. My dad always talked about how great a person he was, how great an athlete, how great just his empathy was just incredible, and I wanted to be him.
You grew up, that's where you grew up, right? Lynchburg, Virginia.
Lynchburg, Virginia. Yeah, born and raised there, and Pierce Street was the place where I was inspired by not only Arthur Ashe but other people that had an impact in my life for becoming an astronaut. I didn't even know it.
Like who?
There was a guy named Chauncey Spencer who. He flew a Lincoln Page tail dragger airplane from Chicago down to Washington, D.C., and walked in and talked to, at the time, Congressman Harry S. Truman, asking him why they can't fund African-Americans to fly in the military. And that seed money that he raised was for the Tuskegee Airmen. So if this guy from Lynchburg, Virginia had not have maybe done that, you know, we might not have had the Tuskegee Airmen, which then led to African Americans flying in space, with the first being, Mae Jemison's first African American woman, and my buddy is escaping me now, who was the first male astronaut. I'll think of it in a minute.
Well, this is interesting because it's not that when you said, no, I don't want to go to the moon, it's not that you're a slacker and it's not that you weren't looking for adventure. In fact, you had been encouraged to do a lot of adventurous things. Talk about your parents and the kind of encouragement they gave you and the sort of things you aspired to. I mean, I guess you give us an idea. Arthur Ashe, great athlete, also, you know, somebody who is noted for standing up for his rights. These were things that were important to you from a young age.
Right. And it was Arthur Ashe, but it was also this woman, Ann Spencer, who was Chauncey Spencer's mother, who was an artist on Pierce Street. And the first NAACP group was born out of her living room with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so this was a place, you know, during the civil rights where people came to be inspired, to put action together to make a difference. And again, I didn't know this at the time. And so in writing this book, Chasing Space, I did some research and found out there were all these connections that helped me get there. My parents were middle school teachers who inspired not only me, but so many people. And when I turned about, I think, sixth grade, my mother gave me a age-inappropriate, non-OSHA certified chemistry set, and I blew up her living room. Uh-huh. And, you know, Frank, that's what fueled my curiosity to be a scientist. I knew that I'd already done it experientially. And so when I went to the University of Richmond on a football scholarship, you know, why not major in chemistry? Because I'd already done it, and I knew how to do that. So having those
or
opportunities.
Or not, barely not.
But once I got to college, I could do that, yeah. You know, I could do that, rightfully do that, and yeah. It would be okay.
Well, so talk more about that. I mean, again, you majored in chemistry, but you were there on a football scholarship, right?
Right. And, I asked the coach, Dal Shealy, when I signed the letter of intent to go to Richmond, I said, can I get a chemistry degree here and play football, knowing that I will miss some of the, you know, the tough practices, you know, because of the laboratories. We only have, you know, it's a small school. We only have so many labs. And so he said, yes, academics is first. You are a student athlete, not an athlete student, which so many kids don't think they can do because of the demands of their athletic, teams. And so I'm just very thankful that my coach, you know, believed enough in that, you know, we have things that we can do besides athletics after we graduate. And, you know, a lot of kids don't even, they want to be professional athletes, but they, you know, you have a better chance of becoming an astronaut than you do a professional athlete if you're in the sciences and engineering. So.
And you did that, and you were a pretty darn good, I mean, athlete, as it turns out. You were drafted and made it to the NFL, right?
Yeah, you know, I was 11th round draft choice out of the University of Richmond in 1986. And, you know, I thought, you know, I never imagined even playing college football because I dropped a touchdown pass in the end zone at my homecoming game. And my coach put me back in the game, said, catch the ball, I believe in you. And the scout from Richmond, he saw me drop the pass. He heard the crowd screaming the second time and then saw him in the end zone doing a little dance. And he said, well, maybe this guy can play for us. And so I've always believed that, you know, there's second chances that you can have. And when I went to the Lions, I pulled a hamstring muscle pretty bad in the second week in training camp. And then I ended up getting cut, the final cut. I played some preseason games. But I started working as a research assistant at the University of Virginia in materials science. And then Dallas signed me for the next season. So when I was, you know, ready to go to Dallas, the people at Virginia said, why don't you enroll in the master's program in materials science engineering? I'm like, why am I going to do that? I'm going to play football for America's team.
Yeah.
And I listen and I enroll. And so I started taking two courses. And when I left to go to Dallas, they videotaped the courses. So there was no online, you know, training back then, but VHS videotapes after practice to complete my my classes. And I ended up pulling my hamstring for the second time with Danny White one morning with Tom Landry looking on. So that was the end of my football career. But
they can send a man to the moon, and they can't do long-distance learning by the time at the time you were learning. I'm thinking the blurb for your book really is he blew up his mother's living room, he dropped a touchdown pass, and still he circled the earth in the space shuttle Atlantis. But that is really your story in a lot of ways about coming back and about keeping your eyes on the prize. I mean, again, let's go back to that moment where you said, oh, you could take a master's program in material science or make, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions in the NFL. And you decided that you better, you know, keep your eyes on the prize a little bit and study the science as well, right?
Right. I mean, I've always enjoyed science and doing things experientially. And, you know, the people that were along my path, they always believed in me. They said, you can do this, you can try this. And I always listened and I just persevered and perceived that I could do those things.
You did? And so tell us how you got to NASA.
I was at a career fair at the University of Virginia, and there was a woman who was recruiting from NASA. Her name was Rosa Webster. And I looked at the NASA booth and I walked past it saying, I'm not going to work for NASA. I'm going to work for DuPont or Dow. And, you know, the federal government doesn't pay as much as these private companies. And so she came around the booth. She grabbed my arm. She said, what's your name? I said, Leland Melvin. She says, I've been looking for you. You're going to work at NASA. I'm like, no, I'm not. And so she then, you know, recruited me to take all of the pamphlets and the books to her car because the career fair was over. And the next week I had an interview down at NASA. And then the week after that I had a job offer. And I said, well, she's pretty persistent. So maybe I'll take this offer. And she also said that you could go back to school and get your PhD while working at NASA. So that was something that was attractive at the time. And I worked there for a few years. And a friend of mine said, Leland, you'd be a great astronaut. I'm like, me? Really? He handed me an application. I didn't fill it out. And that same year, another friend of mine, Charlie Camarda, he filled the application out and he got in. And I said to myself, if NASA's letting knuckleheads like that in to be astronauts, maybe I can be one too. So I applied the next selection. And Charlie actually flew to Langley down in Hampton, Virginia, with John Young, who was, you know, flew on almost every vehicle, walked on the moon, was the first, you know, commander of the shuttle Columbia. And he listened to me talk about my research, but he really fell asleep while I was giving the presentation. And he woke up and he said, Leland, you got to apply. You got to come down here. Charlie, let's get out here and fly back to Houston. And when I interviewed to become an astronaut, he was the first person who spoke up and said, Leland's doing great research, trying to help us get our vehicles safely up to space and back. You know, let's listen to what he has to say.
Leland Melvin is my guest. His book is called Chasing Space, An Astronaut's Story of Grit, Grace, and Second Chances. What's the training like for you? Again, here's a guy who keeps saying no to Esther, right? You said it when you were five. You said it again. And now you're there. I mean, was it exciting to you? When did it finally become the dream, or did it ever, the thing that most of us have always wanted, right? I want to be a spaceman. Did that moment happen for you at some point in this training or some point in this this journey?
Well, I think when John Young, you know, kind of said I had the right stuff, you know, this is a man who walked on the moon, I started, you know, learning more about the program, and it started getting excited because there were 2,500 people that applied. We were down selected about 120, and I was one of those 120 people. And after the interview, once I got selected, training with people from all around the world that have done these incredible things, from, you know, military test pilots to people with dual PhDs, and I'm with them training in Maine doing survival training, or Pensacola doing water survival training, and then flying in these high-performance military jets. It was just amazing. And so the next thing for me was to look at the planet from space, orbiting it at every 90 minutes, seeing a sunrise and a sunset every 45.
What's that like? I never tire of hearing astronauts describe for me the experience of seeing the Earth from that distance and through that that kind of atmosphere and lack of it.
Yeah, I think, Frank, it's when you think you know what you're going to see, but your expectations are exceeded every time. Looking at the Caribbean, you almost need new definitions of blue to describe the colors. I had a few in my vocabulary, you know, cerulean, azure, indigo, you know, navy blue, turquoise, and I'm seeing all these extra colors that I can't even describe. And then, you know, 90 minutes later, you're around the whole entire planet, and it's just phenomenal. And you're, you know, and I thought the task of installing the Columbus Laboratory, which was a multi-billion-dollar laboratory that the European Space Agency had built to attach to the space station. Once I had done that, I thought that would be my aha moment. But it was when Peggy Whitson, the first female commander, invited us over to dinner in the Russian segment. She said, "You guys bring the rehydrated vegetables, we'll have the meat." So we float over, and we're breaking bread at 17,500 miles per hour with people we used to fight against, the Russians and Germans, with the first female commander, an African-American, Asian-American. You know, it's just, it's surreal. And that's when I got my orbital perspective, this shift that most astronauts get when they see the planet and they're working with people. And if you can work together with people you used to fight against in space, you can definitely do it down on the planet.
You talked about those hamstring injuries that had pretty much ended your NFL career, and you had you actually lost your hearing as part of your training at NASA that almost ended that career. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was in the neutral buoyancy laboratory in this suit that looks like a cross between the Michelin Man and the Pillsbury Doughboy. It's the EVA suit, extravehicular activity suit, and there's a little styrofoam block that goes in your helmet. It costs about $2. And they forgot to put mine in. And that's the only way that you can clear your ears if you're the kind of person that needs to squeeze when you go down in an airplane or go down in the ocean. And so with mine not being in there, I couldn't clear. They took me out of the water. They popped my helmet off. The flight surgeon starts walking towards me talking, but I can't hear anything he's saying. And he touches my right ear, and blood starts to flow down like a river down the side of my face. And I am completely deaf. They operate on me. They look to see what could be the cause, but they can't find anything. And my hearing slowly comes back after about 3 weeks, but I'm still hearing impaired in my left ear. And the doctor said, "You'll never fly because we don't know what happened, and this could happen in space, and it would be kind of, you know, catastrophic." And so I kept the path. I stayed, you know, working at NASA. I was working now in education up in Washington, D.C., and that's when the Columbia accident happened. And I went to the different memorial services helping console the families. And the chief of all the flight surgeons was on the airplane when we were flying to the different services, and he watched me clear my ears. And he said, "Leland, I believe in you." And he signed a waiver for me to fly. Mm-hmm. So that was how I got back on flight status.
It's a great story, and it's one that you like to tell, particularly when you encourage young people and young people of color to become active and involved in STEM education, right?
Actually, I'd add the A in there for STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, because all kids have different ways that they can see how they can contribute to the world positively. And the arts is one of them. And we do use the arts all the time, whether it's in space, whether it's documents, whether it's presentations. And so I try to get kids to know that they can do anything and still be part of this. And especially women and minorities who have sometimes been disenfranchised and not seeing people like themselves. Like when I watched Neil and Buzz walk on the moon, I didn't see someone like myself that I didn't even think that I could do it. Plus, I didn't want the buzz cut either. But, you know, letting our children see people like Katherine Johnson, who was a mathematician who helped us get to space and orbit the space with John Glenn going up. And, you know, Katherine was a big influence for me when I worked at NASA. We worked together in helping kids get inspired around SAT tutorials and math contests to know that they can do this just like she could or just like I could.
You have a young reader's edition of your book. Is that much different from the – how is it different from the other book?
It's similar, just the language is maybe a little bit more kid-friendly, and we have experiments in the back of the book for kids to actually perform. So it's STEAM experiments, making rockets and looking at the planets and doing different things where a family could do that at home, you know, experientially with their – now, I don't have anything about blowing things up in the book.
No, the kids actually find that on their own. Thank you, Leland.
They do, right? YouTube, and they get that done pretty quickly. But it's important that the kids can know that there's something for them, especially middle grade kids. That's when they get turned off to science sometimes.
Retired astronaut Leland Melvin has been invited by the Triangle Circle of Hope Foundation to visit this area. He's got several appearances scheduled, including Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight at 7. Thursday, he's going to be on the campus of NC State, and he's going to be signing books at 6 o'clock. We've got all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Leland Melvin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Frank, thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.